Thanks for listening to Funding Rural. I'm Erin Borla with the Roundhouse Foundation in rural central Oregon. Today I'm talking to Margie Hoffman. Margie's the state regional director for the United States Department of Agriculture Rural Development Program. When I first started as a staff member at the foundation, not only did I reach out to foundation leadership, I also reached out to state and federal agencies. I thought about who communities were getting funding from, and I wanted to talk with those organizations. How are you doing that? How did organizations and communities find bigger state and federal grants? Did everybody have equitable access to those applications? I got really connected to our federal partners after the devastating wildfires in Oregon in 2020. I soon met Margie, and she and I hit it off right away. She's a person of action, somebody who wants to get things right, but wants to understand how the system works first. That's where I thought she and I really aligned. Her background is in policy work and braiding funding. It makes her an expert in this role. Fingers crossed, with folks in leadership like Margie, we see big changes and move to access and action from our federal agency partners. It would be a huge benefit to all of our communities. I hope you enjoy our conversation as much as I did. Heads up, the audio quality on this one, not as good as we like, but it really couldn't be helped. My apologies for that. Be sure to stick around after the interview and I'll share some takeaways of my own. And as always, head over to fundingrural.com for show notes and more info about Margie and her work.
So I have been working in Oregon, mostly in rural places, for almost 20 years. That started in working on energy policy, particularly renewable energy, energy efficiency, climate change, natural resources, forestry, and just developed a deep love for the people that I worked with in the communities that I served. When I work with people who are starting in my field for the first time, one of the things I tell them is, like, go try to build something with federal capital. Doesn't matter what it is. Just go try to do it. And not just federal capital, but federal match with state or philanthropic or whatever. There's so much learning that happens when you are out there on the ground. And so when this job opportunity came up, I really wanted to take that very technical experience and weave it back into the way that we think about construct the system as a whole. And was there a place that I could have in the ecosystem of people thinking about programs, funding, program delivery, from that bottom-up perspective that would help us increase the efficiency with which we can get impacts in the ground that serve the people that we are here to serve.
And efficiency is like such an, it's my favorite word when we talk about projects like this, because oftentimes when we think about big projects, especially when we're raising federal capital or state capital, they're not the most efficient. Even the systems are so challenging. So coming from the background, let's step back and talk about Farmers Conservation Alliance and what, like, an example of a project that you're super excited that you got to work on there that sort of leveraged some of that capital. Can you share something like that would be an example?
One of the districts that I love, I'm from Central Oregon, and they're from the just south of Smith Rock, so the backside of Smith Rock. 15 farmers. Some of them are producing tons of peppermint for Colgate, or, you know, they sell into these huge international markets, but you head out there and it's just this humble group of 15 ranchers. There's no executive director. There's not even a district headquarters. The district headquarters is in the back shed of one of the guys, you know, the guy who drew the short straw and has to serve as the board chair. And so when we had an opportunity to leverage some Natural Resources Conservation Service funding to modernize their system, absent that funding, they would have had to do $15 million worth of upgrades on the backs of 15 farmers. Hmm. Nobody has an extra $1 million laying around if you're working in agriculture. The margins are so thin, and so that grant money is absolutely essential in solving the water scarcity issues that so many of us are faced with in the American West right now. So we worked with Lone Pine, and we just packed, I call it the Great Bear Hug. We assessed the skills that they have. We knew what they would need to move forward, and we packed them with the right interdisciplinary team of people to be successful. We were able to use NRCS capital leveraged with the Oregon Department of Water Resources and some funding from the Energy Trust of Oregon as seed capital to modernize their entire system. And so that project likely will wrap up sometime in the next calendar year. So districts that we had seen before that were sophisticated were taking 30 years to go through the entire modernization process. But this district that had no full-time staff was able to get not just to secure the implementation capital, but to get through implementation itself in a 5-year period of time.
Wow.
That is the value of technical assistance funding right there. I just don't think there's a better story to articulate that.
So through your work, whether it's through FCA, when you the example that you used when you talked about the mint farmers, you mentioned some state funding, you mentioned NRCS. Has there been public, private, or philanthropic partnerships with some of those before, like some projects that you did through your previous role, or is this?
I think the big game changer and the reason that FCA was successful in accelerating the sheer amount of work that they were successful in accelerating is that the Energy Trust of Oregon saw the whole vision and invested a not insignificant amount of capital to seed this. So they put money on the table for 12 districts to go through a pilot program all at the same time. So instead of having to start a program $50,000 here, $50,000 here, $50,000 here, $50,000 here, with the delay in figuring out, like, are you going to get the grant, are you not, and the uncertainty that that creates, they were able to launch a program with $2 million of capital. And it was enough capital that they could make mistakes. And they had enough faith and trust from their funder that they were headed in the right direction to be able to make those mistakes and trust that funding wasn't going to get pulled and this bright idea wasn't going to die of its own weight. Because when we're doing this stuff, it's really hard.
Yeah.
We're figuring it out for the first time. So you need that aggregation of capital and those trusting relationships to weather that and know that those, you know, it's like Brene Brown talks about failing up.
Yeah.
That we're all going to fail up together.
Yeah.
And so I think that's the difference maker between the old model of, like, we'll give you 75,000 or 50 or this, that, or the other thing. And we need to start looking at how we work together to aggregate capital around, we're not going to do everything. We don't need to do everything. But can we choose one thing or three things that we could do together with the right partners? Doesn't have to be everybody. Just has to be some of us. And then just go do that. Because if we sit around talking about what color we need to make the t-shirt, we're going to totally miss the opportunity. Money train's going by. We're all standing on the sidelines being like, I think the t-shirt should be blue. No, I think it should be red. It should probably be green.
Yeah. Yeah. And then nobody wears the t-shirt anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
I have a whole closet full of t-shirts from different projects. Well, I think that's so important of, like, how do we, what's the action, right? And when we talk to somebody that's in federal government, it's typically not how do we get to action. It's like, well, let's keep talking about it. So it's exciting to hear that there are these opportunities for action. And I think, you know, in our role as a philanthropic organization working with rural communities, we often hear people say, I'm not even interested in bridging the USDA application. It's too much work. It's too hard. There's too much reporting. And so how, especially with all this new money coming down, we have so many communities that are in such need. How do we work through that together? Is that through technical assistance as well?
You know, I don't want to say that, like, there is no magic bullet in anything that we do. I think that part of it is steering resources in the right place, and part of it is, for lack of a better phrase, trusting that what needs to come together will come together when the time is right. So if somebody's saying, like, I don't want to go through the pain of accessing that capital, they might just not be ready yet. And I trust that, right? They know how to operate their systems better than anybody else in the world. And if there is an easier tranche of capital for them to go after to meet their needs, I want them to have what they need in the most cost-effective and quickest way possible. We work at the direction of our local leadership, and we do have financial tools. So having, you know, somebody who can come out and sit with you and go through your vault and pull together audited financials and be the liaison with the agency, that kind of technical assistance is hugely helpful, because absent that, you're asking somebody who already has a full-time job to take on another full-time job in order to get to implementation. That's why the people who have done this successfully are unicorns. They're putting in 60-hour weeks. They're putting in 80-hour weeks. They're, you know, really good at working with their board. They're really good at raising capital. They're a great grant writer. Like, whatever that is, that secret sauce that makes them successful. So when we look at how do we replicate, how do we make this not a unique thing, but the norm, part of it is deconstructing the unicorns, what made them successful, and then understanding how we can resource that for the people who don't naturally have that skill set.
So you have the vision for that, I think, more so than we've heard in the past of, like, I've been there. I've been as the applicant, whether it's through FCA or others, or even working in policy in the state. So how do you encourage our nonprofit partners, our cities, our counties, our tribes, to be able to say, yeah, that's, I think I could do that. Or I think I could meet with someone to make that happen. Gosh, that'd be great. Mm-hmm. Like, what's your magic way to talk to folks about it?
I think that I always look for the coalition of the willing. I'm willing to work with anybody and everybody. And I think that it is about finding people who are willing to be those early adopters, whether that's a philanthropist relooking at the role of their capital in the system as a whole, whether that is a technical assistance provider who is kind of nervous but ready to scale, whether it's a community leader who's like, I can only tell you what's wrong. I don't know how to fix it, but I know it's going to be really hard, and I'm going to lean in, and I'm going to answer the telephone when you call, even when every bone in my body doesn't want to. Mm-hmm. These people exist everywhere. So what I'm doing at Rural Development is convening the coalition of the willing, looking across private equity, private capital partners, philanthropy, state government, federal government. And from that, when we put people in a room together, magic happens. I don't know how to structure it. It's not often tangible, but projects will come out the back end. And I think it will give us a roadmap of where we can focus our time and investment over the next 18 months, and also provide us, I think that for a lot of people, we just need to demonstrate that change is possible. So when we get to success on 3 or 4 different projects, people in Oregon, it's a really small state, we all look over the fence at our neighbor's laundry and say, I want that, I want that, I want that. How'd you get there? Who'd you talk to? Who'd you work with? How'd you get that? I want a grant. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's about identifying the coalition of the willing, learning how we can work together, and then creating space for more people to come into that system as they're self-selecting into it. I don't think we can take somebody who is not ready for that kind of commitment and change through that process. I think people have to get to the point where they're willing participants and they want change.
The federal government has a huge rural funding stream. Oftentimes it gets returned or not used. But that's why, you know, when you look at philanthropy and philanthropic dollars, it's a very small percentage that goes to rural space. Typically, private funders or community funders fund what they know. But it's just this whole swath of the country that gets missed. And I'm sort of struggling with how to talk about that. But do you hear what I'm trying to get to, maybe? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's a question that always comes up, which is, how do you scale rural? How do you bundle rural? And I think really the heart of that question is, how do you drive down the cost of rural? Because so many of us are used to operating in urban environments where you have easier access to capital, you have easier access to a workforce, You have, you know, you're closer to transportation centers, your materials are going to cost less, projects can come together more quickly. And my response is, I don't think we do scale rural. And rural America is where our forests are harvested, it's where our food is grown, it's where we have our recreation-based economies, you know, these iconic landscapes that are the heart and soul of our country, and people who want to live there. And I don't think that it means that because we can't scale, it means that we turn our back on. I think, so it creates a challenge in that every project is different. We likely won't be able to bundle. You know, we might have opportunities for bundling. We probably wouldn't. But that is why Teddy Roosevelt created the People's Department, which is rural development. We are the only federal agency that is exclusively focused on how do we help support rural communities thrive.
Yeah.
There's so much innovation that happens. We spend a lot of time talking about what's not working. And I don't want to bypass the fact that there are really real challenges that we're working with. But when I get in my car and drive all around the state to these rural pockets, there is an enormous, there is such an incredible amount of success, innovation, resilience that people are working on every single day. And I think that's also a challenge because we can't aggregate and tell those stories.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it cuts both ways. It creates the challenge, but it also creates this kind of, I don't know, I grew up in a rural place. It's like, I grew up on a ranch. It is like this, it feels to me like the soul of America.
Yeah. Gosh, other things that you, I think we're working a lot on private and governmental partnerships, like braiding funding together. So do you have examples of things that you are excited about around opportunities to braid funding here in this state?
I do. There are two opportunities that I'm really excited about that are very near-term opportunities. So one is we were able to secure $500,000 in flexible technical assistance funding. We've entered into a cooperative agreement with Rural Prosperity Partners that will be our cooperator for that project. And Rural Prosperity Partners can raise philanthropic capital. I think that's a really good partnership example that we have with the Roundhouse Foundation. I am very proud of that work. It did not happen overnight. And very proud of the partnership that we have between the federal government, philanthropy, and our cooperator. The other opportunity is we received $500,000 in technical assistance funding for our Rural Energy for America program. And this is a program where we can finance renewable energy or energy efficiency systems for agricultural producers and rural small businesses. So things like, you know, I think about the packing houses in Hood River, or I think about the breweries in Astoria. I think about, you know, just the agricultural producers that are out there looking for any way to cut costs on their margins. This is a really amazing opportunity to not only get them a new energy stream that can cut their costs. Also, we're living in an era of unpredictability where the power companies might need to shut our electricity off. We want them to do that because we do not want the outbreak of catastrophic wildfires triggered by transmission lines when it's too hot, too dry, and too windy. And can you imagine if the packing houses in Hood River Valley lost power for 48 hours, for a week?
Ugh.
The millions of dollars of revenue that would be sunk.
Mm-hmm.
And so I also think that that program is a really key linchpin in not only meeting our climate goals, but increasing our energy resilience so that if that grid needs to come down for any period of time, people have access to energy to run a portion of their, may not power their whole operation, but it can power a pretty significant piece of their operation. That's a really exciting opportunity. Agricultural resilience, cost savings, renewable energy, economic resilience. I think it checks a lot of the boxes that many of us are working towards.
I want to touch just briefly, you mentioned the climate resilience, and I know this is jumping back and forth, but I think the climate resilience piece dovetails nicely into the conversation about disaster resilience, preparedness, mitigation. I know that's something that the USDA has sort of, with the zillions of departments that the USDA has, including the Forest Service and others, there's so much fire mitigation, fire preparedness, climate resilience funding that's coming down. What does that look like for community to access those dollars? Is it the same sort of pool of funding of like, let's find some technical assistance providers, or are there other opportunities to ensure that communities can build resilience themselves?
I think we're just starting to figure out what that looks like. There have not been new programs that are created specifically to address this, except for there is a new program where the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, is designating 1,400 census tracts as resilience zones. Hopefully with that will come funding to proactively build more resilience into those communities. So that could be a potentially new funding stream. We are working really closely at Rural Development with the Forest Service. The Forest Service has a ton of money, and FEMA also has money for pre-disaster mitigation funding. So it starts with the local emergency management plan and putting together, often that's facilitated by the county, writing into that plan what are your emergency preparedness priorities for that county, and then mapping those back to appropriate funding sources. So that's on the prevention side. On the recovery side, I think there's some really disaster is never interesting, but people have done incredible work after living through excruciating experiences in Oregon. Some of the community, Detroit comes to mind, the city of Detroit. So if you drive through that community, 75% of the buildings are new, and we all remember what it used to look like. The store burned to the ground. Like, many of those buildings were just totally burned to ash. They have raised money for it and built a new community center. The community center has a commercial kitchen that can serve 3,000 meals a day. It can provide space for people to come and lay their heads, cot space for people. They have a triage room that's built on the front end of the building that is easy access, that does not have the same entry point as where a normal citizen would come in. And it's got its own space so that triage workers have the privacy and the autonomy to do what they need to do to get done to serve patients. There are ways that they have learned from the fire that they lived through and built differently moving forward to be better prepared for those disasters in the future. There's really, really incredible work happening in Talent, Oregon, with a farm worker community there who was absolutely devastated by the fires. There are culturally specific ways that people are working with that community, architects of that community, serving that community, that are models, frankly, not just for how we recover post-disaster, but they're models that all of us should be incorporating into the way that we think about community and economic development in the future. So I think on the back end, there's this emergence of how do we not build the same? How do we build smarter, better, more climate resilient? We all know what the science says. Science says we're all going to be living through harder climate swings and much tougher times ahead.
Yeah, I think, and that's a way that I think philanthropy can come together with government entities, whether it's state or county or federal or city or whatever it is, to one, elevate community, right? Elevate projects like the Detroit Community Center. I mean, it's something as simple as they have an eyewash station. Like, that's something that nobody thinks about when they're building. Or the triage room of, yeah, we have a triage room, but it's at the back of the building, and you got to go through where everybody stays. So having some of those models available, so being able to elevate those projects that are super successful, encourage communities that we may be working with or partners that we may be working with to know they're not the first. They don't have to be the first to go through those things. How do we build off of projects that have already happened and connect those people, right? We have like Mackenzie Bridge, which is another community that went through those 2020 wildfires that basically has said, whoever wants to work with us, we will show them what we've done. Mm-hmm. We've done this so others don't have to. And I think that's our job, is to be able to tell those stories and make those connections and then see how we can build funding options together to have those projects happen. But to think we consistently have to reinvent the wheel and be the first, we're not the first.
No.
Sorry.
Yeah, totally.
It's like, darn, I wanted to be. Oh my goodness. I'm so glad you were here. Thank you so much for spending some time and talking about what you're working on, and so thrilled to be in partnership with all the wonderful things you're doing.
Thank you as well. You're doing really incredible work in the state, and just feel really grateful that we get to partner on so many things. So thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for listening along today with Margie. And I think, you know, there were a lot of takeaways for me throughout this episode. A lot of them come back to the projects that she worked on when she was at Farmers Conservation Alliance. Talking about that partnership between 15 different farmers here in Central Oregon and just a little bit of technical assistance allowed them to not only access capital for their project to modernize infrastructure, but also excel in the timeline. So the project was completed significantly faster. I think that's really important as a way that philanthropy can come together around some of these things and some of these projects. Because if we really do want strategy and want to focus on how we can make big, sweeping systems change, the reality is we need action. And to be able to have projects that we can implement on the ground by bringing people together that are already working in that system feels like a really great move. She used the term finding the coalition of the willing, which makes sense for us as funders. Find ways to amplify what's already working on the ground and working well with people really ready to make moves. Building on that, Margie talked about deconstructing unicorns, which I think is great. Studying what has worked in funding relationships and rural projects, learning from that and applying it in other projects. We all like to think we're going to invent the wheel, but the truth is we don't have to. And we could use our time better by studying those who have found success, even if we have to pull projects apart. Braiding funding together, private, government funding, state, federal funding, to learn from disasters and build back, more resilient in the future. Philanthropic organizations have an important role to play in bypassing red tape, reporting requirements required by agencies. It's not about working in isolation, private versus public funding streams, but rather how we come together to get the job done for community. In spite of different constraints different partners may face, let's be nimble. Let's move fast and help grassroots projects experiment. Sometimes we might fail, but let's learn from those missteps and build to something better. Thanks so much for following along. As always, you can check out fundingrural.com for a transcript of this episode and more show notes.